You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, May 24th, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. Mm-hmm. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, economist Nathan Tankus, author, The Notes on the Crisis newsletter. Also on the program today, Jessica Valenti, author of the Abortion Every Day newsletter on Substack. Also on the program today, Republicans continue to roll over Joe Biden, increasing demands for cuts and increasing demands for spending on the military.
What?
Meanwhile, House Republicans look to repeal Biden's student loan debt forgiveness. And Tiny D set to announce his presidential run with Tiny E on Twitter tonight.
To the tiniest audience possible.
Hosted by Tiny DS, David Sachs.
Oh,
there you go.
Woo!
Trump hush money criminal trial set for March of 2024, just a couple of weeks after Super Tuesday.
I love that timing.
And an indictment rumored to be coming shortly on the stolen docs case. Again, reminder, we're anticipating an indictment coming out of Georgia in August. So a busy 12 months for Donald Trump coming up. John Roberts says the court will work on his ethics. Everyone laughs. South Carolina Senate passes a six-week abortion ban. Montana bans people dressed in drag from reading books to children. Florida school bans a poem that kicked off the Biden inauguration. Target.
A black girl read
yep.
it? Okay.
Target pulls LGBTQ merch amid sometimes violent right-wing protesters. And today marks 1 year since the Uvalde shooting, mass shooting. Still, no answers from the cops as to why it took them so long to respond. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is, of course, the day that has basically bankrolled Emma Vigeland. Emma? Why don't you tell us what...
It's hump day.
There you go.
And it's hump day.
Ka-ching every time. Every time you say that.
Yeah.
This joke has gotten so old.
I know, but... I mean,
I wonder exactly how old it is.
The joke?
Yeah.
Well, can't be more than 2 years. Two or three years.
Maybe someone can trace
the
genesis of it. I started in November 2020.
November 2020?
About a 2.5-year-old joke.
Oh, geez. Well, I don't think we started right away. Probably
no. Yeah.
Probably took like 3 months.
I was talking
months.
About Emma's appearance on the show. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh!
It's probably a 2-year-old joke. So I probably only done it like, you know, probably 100 times. Right?
Yeah.
It
gets better every time.
Every
Keep
time.
It up.
It's just like fine wine. Let's get right into this. You know, John Roberts, there's two things you can do when you're faced with all the ethical issues that the Supreme Court has. One is you can deal with those issues. The other is you can say that you're going to deal with those issues. And guess which option John Roberts has taken. Here he is doing his best to salvage his – Chief Justicery, I guess.
And on a final issue of concern inside the court,
I want to assure people that I am committed to making certain that we as a court adhere to the highest standards of conduct. We are continuing to look at things we can do to give practical effect to that commitment.
I pause it. Could you pull up the written standards of conduct for the Supreme Court? Could you put that up on the screen, please? Oh, there is none.
Ah.
But I mean, he assures you.
Is he working on it?
They will abide by it.
We're thinking of some.
He doesn't even say that. Go back and just listen to this. This guy's
Trust
a lawyer.
Trust
the guy's
us.
A lawyer. He's making it clear he's going to be holding themselves to the highest measure of conduct, but that doesn't exist.
No issue of concern inside the court. I want to assure people that I am committed to making certain that we as a court adhere to the highest standards of conduct.
Sure.
We are continuing to look at things we can do to give practical effect to that commitment. And I am confident there are ways to do that are consistent with our status as an independent branch of government under the Constitution's separation of powers.
Can you pause it for a sec? The focus on independence there, I think, is also key, given the fact that he's a lawyer. I mean, he's trying to reiterate that the Supreme Court answers to no one except for themselves,
yeah.
Which is the whole damn problem, bro.
Like, the problem here is that there is, like, other branches of government saying, hey, or may conceivably be like, hey,
yeah. Right, you don't, we're not going to subject ourselves to any type of judicial, to any type of congressional oversight of
He's
our behavior.
Finger wagging at we're Dick Durbin.
Yep.
And why do the, like, talking points that John Roberts is spewing out here sound eerily similar to, like, a corporation
exactly.
when they have to backpedal on, like, sexual misconduct or something or rampant abuse within the company? This is a government, one of the three major branches of government in this country, and they're acting like... This is like a CEO giving some TED talk or
it sounds
he's
McKinsey.
At Davos saying, well, we know we've had a bad year of some issues here. No, you're accountable to us.
Yeah. Give practical effect to our values. Yeah, sure. Man.
But unfortunately, they're not because they're the high priests of the United States.
Highest standards of conduct, whatever that means. And we're trying to figure out how we're going to make that work in the context of us still wanting to go to billionaire retreats.
The standards are so high we can't even put them down in text because it's really only for us to know.
They're
God.
Ordained to us. I mean, literally, that's how they view themselves.
We put it out on tab. We put tablets out and we wait for lightning. And that's how we get them written. Go ahead.
There are ways to do that are consistent with our status as an independent branch of government under the Constitution's separation of powers. Thank you very
much. Whoa, he really went to town on this. This was I just want you to know, I mean, it literally is him just saying, like, I read the papers, and apparently we have an ethics problem. So...
I acknowledge that. I see
you. I acknowledge that.
Yeah. I hear you.
We're doing a lot about
Believe
that, trust me.
No one cares more about this than me, and you can take that to the bank.
It's like my parents are on vacation, like, hey, you been mowing the lawn? Like, oh yeah, we are. Doing
Don't you worry.
Looking at all sorts of high standards for lawn mowing.
Absolutely. And I am presently looking at ways in which we could achieve the highest standards of lawn mowing.
It's like a jungle outside.
We're just going to need a little time.
But then you would have to feasibly mow the lawn before your parents get back to cover your ass. In this instance, no. You don't have to do anything.
And folks, and mom, dad, yeah. Don't forget, based upon our arrangements, you never come back here.
Yeah.
So speaking of, and maybe, I don't know if this was a coincidence. I mean, is it possible that Harlan Crowe is in constant contact with members of the court? Yes, it is. In fact,
just
it's
friends.
Best
Undoubtedly.
Friends.
The group chat.
But here is Harlan Crowe and his attorney, Gibson Dunn. That's a huge white shoe law firm in Washington. We represent Harlan Crowe in relation to your letters of May 8th. This is written to Dick Durbin, the chairman of the U.S. Senate Committee on the Judiciary.
Who's barely done anything, and they're still, like, threatening him, essentially.
I mean, this is almost the identical tone, incidentally, from what we just played.
Mm-hmm.
We represent Harlan Crowe in your relations to your letters of May 8th, 2023, the letters. Today, we are also responding on behalf of CH Asset Company, Cary Commercial Limited, and Top Holdings LLC. These are probably all Harlan Crowe's outfits. We recognize the important role the Senate Judiciary Committee has in considering legislation related to our federal court system.
Mm.
And we appreciate the opportunity to engage with the committee. You know what else the Senate has authority for? Oversight. Not just legislation, oversight. They have investigatory committees because they have the power to investigate. Just to make that clear. After careful consideration, we do not believe the committee has the authority to investigate Mr. Crowe's personal friendship with Justice Clarence Thomas. Most importantly, Congress does not have the constitutional power to impose ethics rules and standards on the Supreme Court. Doing so would exceed Congress's Article I authority and violate basic separation of powers principles. That precludes the committee from pursuing an investigation in support of such legislation. The hubris here, and let's be clear, it is they don't believe that they have the authority to investigate Crowe's personal friendship, and then goes on to say that it doesn't have the power to impose ethics. I'm not clear that that's the case either, frankly.
Of course not.
They're not the OLC.
And also, Harlan Crowe is a citizen of the United States.
He doesn't.
I know he's a doesn't.
Billionaire.
He thinks that he's above everything because he's a billionaire. But in reality, we just saw this with Howard Schultz. Even billionaires can get hauled in front of congressional committees if you have a chair that actually wants to do his goddamn job, like Bernie Sanders did, not Dick Durbin. This might actually scare Dick Durbin because he's that much of a
better. Little. There better be the next meeting is when they should be issuing the subpoena. And then let's see what happens then. That's just absurd. The idea they can call him up there for anything. Unbelievable. The hubris of these people is just amazing.
It's sickening.
They don't even have to pretend. We're going to talk to Nathan Tankus, who writes the Notes on the Crisis newsletter. In a minute, we're going to talk to him about mint and the coin, among other potential avenues to deal with this debt ceiling crisis. May bring up some inflation. I got a couple of inflation questions to ask him, too. But first couple words from our sponsors. Today, one of our sponsors is Roan. Yesterday, not only did I buy another shirt. Well, first of all, I wore my Roan shirt yesterday.
This is a real story here. This our others aren't, but
no. But this is a story that you actually witnessed.
Yes.
After the show, I had to, do two things. I had to go to a sit shiva, and so I dressed up a little bit for that, and then I went to go to a premiere.
Mm.
Of a movie.
Very fancy.
Friends,
Total Media Elite.
Total Media Elite. It wasn't a big fancy movie, but...
That's a big movie that's coming. Whatever.
No.
Yeah, okay.
I put on my Roan Commuter Collection shirt, and it looked good, didn't it?
Well, I asked you, I said, is that the Roan shirt? Because it looks just like a dress shirt.
It's a dress shirt. It's a dress shirt, except for it's much more comfortable. It fits much better. And the beauty is I brought it down here, rolled up in my crappy, travel bag, not wrinkled at all. Roan's Commuter Collection is the most comfortable, breathable, and flexible set of products known to man. And here's why. It helps you get ready with any for any occasion. They have the most comfortable pants, dress shirts, quarter zips, and polos. You never have to worry about what to wear when you have the Roan Commuter Collection. Roan's comfortable four-way stretch fabric. Stretchy, I don't know how that works.
No, it means
it's breathable. I know.
Wrinkles
you keep telling
less.
Me, but yes, it definitely
does. It goes four ways, north, south, east, west.
And you can go, it can take you from your commute to work to your 18 holes of golf, which I don't play. But for me, I could throw baseball around with Saul with it in the park. Time to feel confident without the hassle. Rhone's wrinkle release technology. Wrinkles disappear as you stretch and wear the products. It's that easy. It has gold fusion anti-odor technology. And Rhone is 100% machine washable. You can ditch the dry cleaner altogether. I literally just bought another Rhone shirt, blue this time, yesterday. And I got a pair of shorts this morning.
Whoa.
I don't think that's the commuter collection. I think it was the everyday shorts, 8 inches. But whatever. Meanwhile, it's just the most versatile, comfortable, ready-to-wear clothes you can imagine. The commuter collection can get you through any workday and straight into whatever comes next. Head to Rhone, A-R-H-O-N-E, R-H-O-N-E, Rhone.com/MajorityReport. Use the promo code MajorityReport. Save 20% off your entire order. And another product I've been using, more or less on a daily basis, sometimes I forget. We had talked about this, the way that this whole happened with Nutrafol. Years ago, Nutrafol sponsored the program. I thought I could get Michael to try it. I mean, he was thinning a little bit, and he wasn't interested. But then years later, they came back to us, and Emma had said that you had a friend who had a success with it.
She had some health issues and lost some hair, and it really helped her.
And I had heard good things, and then it turns out I know somebody who knows the guy who made it. And the story, I don't know why they don't tell this story. They probably don't want to. But Nutrafol, it works. And the beauty is you don't have to choose between hair growth and your health, because Nutrafol is a holistic solution for men and for women, frankly, that promotes both healthier hair and whole body wellness. I started taking it. And because I was feeling like you know, receding, I'm like, now's the time to do it. And I am getting like much like tiny. You can tell that you got it because I got hair that's like half the size of my other hair that's growing.
New hair.
Yep. And I feel good on it. I feel like I'm getting more, you know, it deals with improving your hair growth, your thickness, visible scalp coverage. Nutrafol's hair growth nutraceuticals go beyond genetics to multi-target the root causes of thinning, including stress, hormones, nutrition, metabolism, aging, and lifestyle through whole body health. And I will say that I have both stress, probably a lack of hormones, poor nutrition, slow metabolism, and very much aging. It's helping me with all of those things. Physician formulated using natural medical grade ingredients, Nutrafol's drug-free patented technology provides consistent, reliable results without compromising your sexual health. In a clinical study, men showed progressive improvement in hair growth and thickness after 3 and 6 months. Nutrafol is also trusted and recommended by more than 3,000 top doctors. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support your health and our show by going to Nutrafol.com, entering the promo code TMR to save $10 off your first month subscription. This offer is only available in the U.S. Customers for a limited time, plus free shipping on every order. Get $10 off at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code TMR. We will put both those links into the podcast and YouTube descriptions and on the website. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking to Nathan Tangus. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome to the program economist Nathan Tangus, author of the Notes on the Crisis newsletter. Nathan, welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure to be here.
All right, I want to start with a piece you wrote yesterday. I guess it is. I'm looking at the date. And because we run into this all the time, too. And this notion, because sometimes I think it's very hard for people to really understand how incompetent politicians can sometimes be. I mean, honestly, I've used this example many times before, but back in the days when we were at Air America, which was the radio network, people would send us emails saying, like, we think there's a mole working in your place because, and I thought, like, this is actually not an irrational reaction to have because I'm inside this building and it's hard for me to believe the level of incompetence I'm witnessing. And I can't help but think that that's what's going on here. And you wrote a piece yesterday dealing with that. Let's just start with that when we're talking about the debt ceiling. Your assessment of, like, why we are watching this, like, slow-motion debacle happen coming out of the White House.
Yeah. I mean, there's many different places that you can start. But I think one key place to just start is Biden himself. So much of what Biden has come with into his administration, for good and for ill, has been his quote-unquote lessons that he's taken from being a first-hand witness to what was going on in the Obama administration. And in one example, that was good. He was absolutely convinced that we should just get out of Afghanistan. That was the last thing he'd really thought about that subject. And he just had stuck with that and got out despite the chattering classes all screaming against it. So in that example, it was good. In the debt ceiling example, it's not so good. So the last time he paid attention, 2011, that was seen as, you know, didn't go well in a certain sense, although there was political advantage and the idea that somehow that had some relation to Obama getting elected. I'll get back to that. But then in 2013, after Obama wins, the Republicans are weakened, the sort of like Tea Party energy wave is in a complicated different place. And Biden looks at that, remembers that period, and thinks, well, the debt ceiling increases then were mostly clean debt ceiling increases. There was like a little bit of like putting congressmen's wages into escrow, congresspeople's wages into escrow. There was a little bit of like, let's create a bipartisan conference on the debt, blah, blah, blah. But for the most part, they did not successfully use the debt ceiling as a chip to get cuts. That wasn't what they were able to do with it. And other things were going on, like the government shutdown. But they weren't able to use the debt ceiling as this big hostage speech in 2013. And so that's the last time Biden's really, really thought about these issues. So Biden's thought is, well, let's just do 2013 again. And that's where this idea of not doing any negotiations come from. If we just say we won't negotiate, that's a position of strength. They'll fold over like they did in 2013. And that's really the core issue is this, that we're in a very different political situation, that Trump happens, that the transformation of the Republican Party under Trump, and that Republicans don't feel weak the way they did in 2013. And also, you didn't have very different style of Republicans who could more readily cede to business pressure, and there was business pressure to cede to. That was fundamentally what our core problem is it's a playbook that has not paid attention to how the terrain has changed.
And they thought that McCarthy wouldn't be able to get that cut, save, and whatever bill, his budget bill. They thought he wasn't going to be able to pass that. And they seemingly had absolutely no concept that we might need a plan B. And you make this argument that it is really just a. It's a failure of strategy. It's a failure of competence, however you want to characterize that. But it's not some type of secret way of introducing austerity, because this would be the stupidest way to possibly do it, it seems to me. Like, they don't get any political value out of it. They don't get any political cover, and it's not an effective way of austerity. It's just incompetence.
Well, there is a way. I mean, my story, I would say, is a mixture of incompetence and maliciousness, because there is a piece of it that is malicious, that is dangerous, which is starting the game of chicken itself. And you start the game of chicken by saying these unilateral options are so terrible, we can't do them, because if a unilateral option is viable, then it gives you, quote unquote, too much negotiating leverage. And thus, there's no possibility of coming together to do a deal. You might actually be forced to do one of your unilateral options. And from their point of view, they think that was right. The political loser. So the idea is always that bipartisanship is supposed to be the political winner, that there is some big audience among American voters for bipartisanship that will then show your seriousness and realness and all of that. So there is malicious in the sense that they are telling stories. They are lying about unilateral options in order to get a game of chicken. And they're fine with doing some cuts to get there. If they ultimately at the end get a little bit of cuts and, you know, some there that, you know, that ultimately gets the deal, they'll do that, and they don't care about who gets hurt from that. What hasn't worked out is that they screwed up the game of chicken. They thought that they could get a game of chicken, they'd get a deal, there'd be a little bit of cuts, and they would look, and then like that would make the Republicans look bad, that would make them look good. Things would work out. Instead, the Republicans are just not interested in negotiating. The Republicans are saying, Matt Gaetz said it yesterday. You know, the people in their caucus don't feel like, quote, negotiating with their hostage.
Let's play this clip for a second, because I have some questions as to who the hostage is here that he's referring to, because it could be like a half a dozen different options. As to who that might be. Here's that clip.
Pulling it up.
we're pulling it up.
Yeah.
All right. Forget. The point is, do we have it?
Yeah. We.
All right. Let's just read the clip. We don't need the clip.
No, we got it right here. We got it. So this is a Semaphore reporter, Joseph Zabalos-Roig, essentially speaking to Matt Gaetz.
Would you say then the conservatives like yourself are becoming more pessimistic about the state of negotiations if, you know, there's a bipartisan deal in sight, maybe? Or how would you like characterize the mood among your conservative colleagues right now?
I think my conservative colleagues, for the most part, support limit safe growth, and they don't feel like we should negotiate with our hostage.
Okay, who is the hostage? Wait, is it Kevin McCarthy?
It could be. I mean, I interpret it, and I think this is straightforward, that the hostage is Biden. That the hostage is the Biden administration.
Is it the economy? Is it the economy broadly?
I mean, that's another, the economy as well as the hostage, but I think fundamentally, it's Biden. They feel like they have him trapped, and they're right, because the Biden administration is doing everything possible to talk down the unilateral options, to get a negotiation, to force Republicans to the table to accept a deal with cuts. And the Biden administration has given up any leverage, and it's just said, you know, this is us. This is our issue. We're screwed.
Wink, wink. We should all just do this. And the Republicans are basically saying, well, it looks like we don't just have to do this. They're now asking for going beyond grow, limit, save, or whatever the name of that bill is. And they're asking for more money for the military. So, they're just, and this has happened to Biden before in the past, where he tries to give up everything and they just won't take yes for an answer. And so let's talk about, and I want to get into the two sort of like unilateral things that you've argued. One, of course, is Mint the Coin. The other is just the 14th Amendment. But the premise, it seems to me, of both those unilateral actions is how is Joe Biden, and there's a court case almost around, to this effect. I don't know if it hits it directly on that matter in Boston, but Joe Biden, how can he stay within his constitutional parameters and not employ a unilateral mechanism to go through the debt ceiling? Because he doesn't have the constitutional authority to appropriate or to tax. That is Congress's. And he doesn't have the universal authority to have a line item veto. That's already been shown to be unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So he can't not do the spending that Congress has already authorized. So how does he have any constitutional standing to abide by the debt limit?
Yes. So this is you know, the classic paper on this is the Columbia Law Review paper was very kind of talked about in the Obama White House. Buchanan and Dorff, a paper titled Choosing the Least Unconstitutional Option. And their framing was exactly what you're talking about, that you have this spending obligation, and, you know, spending and taxing is Congress's prerogative. You can't impound things. That's the spending power. And then on top of that, there's the 1974 Impoundment Act, because Nixon tried to arbitrarily choose what to spend and what not to spend. And Congress passed an act specifically, you know, making sure that that isn't a possibility, or trying to rule that out. You have a certain amount of authority to issue a certain amount of Treasury securities. You have a cap on that. And you have the debt ceiling, you have your spending obligation, and you have 14th Amendment, or just Section 1, Article 8 of the Constitution. You know, the debts must be honored. So what do you do with that? Where you can't default, where spending and taxing is prerogative of Congress, and you have this cap for the debt ceiling. And so Buchanan and Dorff's answer is break the debt ceiling. That's the least unconstitutional option, is simply ignoring the debt ceiling law. Some other people argue that you can say that the debt ceiling is simply unconstitutional itself and is an invalid statute.
The only constitutional there, I mean, there's nothing constitute there. There's a problem insofar as that you're maybe the executive branch is ignoring the will of Congress in terms of the statute. But the debt ceiling, we should say, is the only one that of these directives that is not in the Constitution. Could very well be contrary to the Constitution.
Yeah. So there's a constitutional obligation generally to follow statute. And so there's a debate, you know, the only argument out of whether breaking through the debt ceiling is just affirmatively constitutional is if the debt ceiling itself is unconstitutional, would be ruled unconstitutional. The thing is that there's more financing authorities than just the debt ceiling. So the debt ceiling can be constitutional if you have alternative ways of financing spending, and thus, you know, dealing with this potential mismatch between financing authority and spending obligation. And minting a $1 trillion platinum coin is one of those financing options. It can mint a $1 trillion platinum coin, deposit it at the Federal Reserve, make payments out of their bank account at the Fed. And that's the way that the debt ceiling would be consistent with the president's otherwise constitutional obligation.
Can you explain, just for folks who were not around 10 years ago when this became like a necessity to sort of develop this idea, what it is? I mean, go ahead. The Treasury has the ability to mint money and.
Yeah, so the Treasury, you know, mints coins all the time. Normally, the laws around coinage set the face value, meaning just like a penny is a penny. It's worth 1 cent. Quarter is 25 cents. A dollar, $1 coin, so on and so forth. Generally, the Congress is very tight with the denomination of the coins. An exception was Coinage Act in 1997, what's now in the U.S. Code. Section U.S. Code Section 31, Section 5112K says that it goes against that usual tradition. It says that the Treasury Secretary can direct for a platinum coin to be minted of any denomination as serves the needs of the United States. So it's completely unlimited discretion on the denomination. Now, of course, when they passed that act, they weren't thinking about these larger kind of macro budgetary questions. They wanted to just sell some commemorative coins, especially overseas. But the purpose was explicitly to get seigniorage revenue for the United States. And they knew that they were opening the discretion. You know, Philip Deal, the U.S. Mint director at the time, who wrote this, who co-wrote this and then found a Republican congressman to pass the bill with him, Mike Castle, he is an advocate for minting a trillion-dollar coin, says that it totally fits the original idea of why they were motivated to write the coin. They just didn't imagine this further step, which is, since it's legal tender, you can then go deposit it at the Federal Reserve, which is our banker. The technical phrase is fiscal agent, and they have an obligation to provide us payment services, which includes accepting deposits and making payments on our behalf. So the Fed is obligated to accept this legal tender when the Treasury proffers it on deposit, and then it fills up our bank account.
What was the biggest platinum coin that they had minted? They've minted in the wake of that legislation.
I'd have to check. I think maybe like $500 or something, maybe $1,000. I have to check. I don't know.
How much money do they think they were going to raise on that?
I mean, it was a penny ante thing. Like, I mean, you're hoping, I think it's like what's thinking in terms of like the hundreds of millions.
Huh. All right. And so this authority,
it was quite successful program, very successful program. You know, they sold a ton of them in Japan. Phil Deal knows his stuff.
All right, there it is. I mean, we raised a couple $100 million. I mean, it seems like it seems like not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things, but the authority exists there. And once you put it in the Fed pays off what does that do?
I mean, it's just like filling up your bank account. It increases the bank account. So there's the Treasury's bank account is called the Treasury General Account. It usually keeps a couple $100 billion in there. Because of the debt ceiling, it's been running down that balance, and that would fill right up, and the Treasury would then start spending out of that account. They could, if they wanted to, then go out and buy Treasury securities back, and, you know, get some further breathing room for the debt ceiling, or they could just sit on the funds and let the money roll down in their account as the U.S. deficit spends, as it was already on track to do, the same amount. It doesn't authorize any more spending. It's just financing the spending that's already been.
But you could buy back some of the debt too with it as well, right?
Absolutely. Just like they can buy back debt right now. I mean, some people have suggested, with interest rates a lot higher, for the Treasury to engage in a big buyback, to buy back longer maturity debt, issue shorter maturity debt, and, you know, buy themselves a little breathing room with the debt ceiling.
The idea is like we're gonna just buy a bunch of CDs. In consumer parlance, I guess, go out and get whatever percent it is. And what is the fear associated with this?
I think the fear is two things. I think the main thing is just the ridiculousness factor. It sounds ridiculous. There's nothing centrist Democrats hate more than looking foolish, even though they look really foolish right now. This type of sort of doing something unconventional, you know, the Keynes quote about how, you know, most people would rather fail conventionally than succeed unconventionally. There's just a sense that inherently you're going to do something ridiculous, make you look ridiculous. And even if it were actually to cut off this debt ceiling fight, that you would lose politically from the embarrassment that you did some silly thing and, you know, made the U.S. a laughing stock.
The stupidest thing that I've heard about all of this is that this is actually like anything other, like to the extent that there is any price to pay politically in any of this, it is completely manufactured by the people trying to avoid paying a price politically. The general population only hears that there's some type of like debt crisis in the same way that there's like a hurricane that is coming. Yeah. And the idea that like we would have an ability to sort of like, we also happen to have a hurricane zapping device that can eliminate the hurricane. Yes, we reported the other day that there was a Hurricane 5 that was about to hit New Orleans. And actually, we deployed the hurricane zapping device. End of story. Move on to the next story. Nobody cares. Nobody cares, it seems like, except for in some sort of a parallel universe.
Like Beltway media, centrist writers. I mean, that's the constituency that they're appealing to with this.
It's exactly. Stunning. It's stunning to me.
I mean, a lot of people genuinely believe that you mint a trillion-dollar coin, trillion-dollar platinum coin, and you deposited it at the Fed, and payments start going out, and Americans will realize that money is fake, and they will lose all confidence in the dollar. They will then go on a spending spurge that causes hyperinflation. I've had serious conversations. I have been in rooms with former Federal Reserve officials where this kind of conversation happens. Like, the elite people who have either in the past or currently actually involved in real governmental decisions believe this kind of thing.
They also believe it kind of relative to student debt, right? Where it's like, well, if people realize that debt can just be eliminated, what does that say for other kinds of debts?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they genuinely, there are people who really believe this stuff who have made consequential governmental decisions in the last 30, 40 years.
What does this mean about the 14th Amendment, though? Because I'm very confused when just going back to Biden's negotiations here. He kind of came out and said, I'm considering it. And we all thought that was BS, right? Because it's completely not in his nature. Now he's just saying, oh, it would take too long. But why a few weeks ago was he publicly discussing the possibility of the 14th Amendment? And can you flesh out a little bit more of what that option might look like if, you know, it were to happen, which we now know it's not going to?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a few things there. One is a proper legal analysis is that even invoking the 14th Amendment means doing something like minting the coin. Or issuing bonds, you know, there's this whole other weird thing we can talk about, which is the debt ceiling applies to the face value of the debt. So if you issue debt that have big coupons, meaning they offer a lot of interest, but the face value is low, and then you offer them an auction and people buy them, you know, they buy them for 5% interest and that ends up meaning they're paying way above face value, then you can sort of get around the debt ceiling. And this is, you know, this is some other different gimmick that some people like more, including some centrists. Like Josh Barrow likes that gimmick better than he likes the coin. And so regardless, whether it's the weird bonds or the coin, invoking the 14th Amendment is doing those things because you have to do the most constitutional thing first. And the most constitutional thing first is one of those options. Now, if you ignored all the sort of workaround type things, there are others I could mention, which are even more obscure. It's not worth talking about. Then the other option would simply just be issue treasury debt. Just like follow the same auction schedule that they already were following. Just keep on issuing and they would have more treasury securities outstanding than the debt ceiling cap, and they're essentially just ignoring the debt ceiling.
Right. You just pretend like that law doesn't. I've gone to the Office of Legal Counsel at the DOJ. They've said this law is actually unconstitutional. If you follow this law, you will be breaking the Constitution, and that's it. And And their whole argument about we need this to be resolved quickly is sort of belied by the fact that they're not allowing the court case that's taking place in Boston right now to do that function. But I think it gets back to what you said earlier, which is to the extent that there's maliciousness here, and I would argue that your assessment of that is right in that instance, is that they're okay with some cuts. It's not their agenda, but they're okay with some cuts because the important thing is they think that this has more political value to them than actually doing the thing that would resolve the problem in a more efficient way. It's insane. Nathan Tankus, I want to bring you back to talk a little bit about inflation, too, particularly as this sort of like notion of maybe it was, in fact, that these huge profits contributed to inflation. Thanks so much for your time. We will put a link to your newsletter that folks should be reading on a daily basis. Thanks so much, Nathan.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jessica Valenti. She is the author of Abortion Every Day newsletter. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Jessica Valenti. She's the author of the newsletter on Substack, Abortion Every Day. Jessica, it feels like you may have to up it to like twice a day.
Every hour.
It really is nuts what's going on. Maybe we should just work our way temporally backwards. Because over the past 48 hours or something, we've seen new bans that have been imposed. Let's start with South Carolina, because it'll give us an opportunity to both talk about the length of these, you know, the supposed lengths associated with these bans, and the notion of exceptions, because I think you really articulate a point about exceptions that we've been talking about for a long time, but I think you do it very well. So let's talk South Carolina.
Sure. So South Carolina, the Senate passed a 6-week ban last night. That's expected to go to the governor. Governor is expected to sign it. The goodish news is that it's going to go to the Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court has already blocked a previously passed 6-week ban. So this is like another effort by Republicans in the state to get something going.
Yeah, I was confused about that. What changed? Was there different wording, or was this
they're switching around like slight bits of language. They're hoping that the 6 weeks and that some of the exceptions will convince the justices, who seemed somewhat interested in passing an abortion ban, but felt like the last ban was still unconstitutional. It's not entirely clear. Clearly, Republicans think that this one is going to pass legal muster with them. But it's just, you know, they keep trying and they keep trying. Unfortunately, this time around, the female senators who filibustered last time weren't able to make that happen again. But they're just unrelenting. Right. They're just completely unrelenting. And they want, both in South Carolina and in North Carolina, they want to talk about these bans as if they're reasonable, as if the exceptions somehow make it OK, even though, as you said, the exceptions aren't real. Right. So it's just a nightmare all around.
Can you talk about the nature of exceptions in general from a macro level? Because for me, I have no interest in even engaging in that debate, because, as you say, they're unrelenting because they're fundamentalists. And fundamentalism means that fundamentally they are not going to compromise because God is telling them that this is the right way to create a society. Like, just if in following this every day, What is your message to our audience who might be engaged in these debates when exceptions come up? Like, what is their role that you see in state legislatures in terms of diluting the real brutality of what is being implemented?
Yeah, exceptions don't do anything except give Republicans the opportunity to claim that they are somehow being reasonable or conceding something, right? Like, it's purely a messaging tactic. When you look at the exceptions, it's not just the hurdles that are involved, right? With like a lot of rape and incest exceptions, they'll make it impossible because you have to do these police reports. You have to, right? If you look at a state like Mississippi, for example, that has a rape exception on the books, they did a study and they couldn't find one single doctor who would perform an abortion for a rape victim, right? And so they know the only reason they're putting these exceptions in is because they know they're not going to work. And so when anyone brings up exceptions to me, usually what I say is, show me one person. Show me one person who's been able to get an abortion under these exceptions. Because you can't find them. They don't exist. It is completely absurd. And what makes me really frustrated is that Democrats will talk about them as if there's too many hurdles, they're too strict, right? But they won't come out and say they're fake. They don't exist. This is complete and utter nonsense. The only reason that they're in there, they would never, as you said, they're fundamentalists. They would never put language in these bills that would allow women to get abortions. And when people bring up the rape and incest exceptions in particular, I point out, well, look what's happening in Texas, right? Where women are literally dying. They're going into sepsis and they can't get abortions. If these women can't get abortions, do you really think a rape victim is going to be able to get an abortion? No,
we can't solve rape cases in this country. We have an embarrassingly low rate, let alone they understand that any kind of investigative process would then time out the ability for the abortion to happen. And that's what is just so frustrating for me about having to engage in this debate on their terms, which is why we shouldn't.
No, we absolutely shouldn't. And the other thing is, a lot of it is about cruelty, right? So take South Carolina. In the bill that they passed last night, the rape exception says a doctor, before they perform an abortion on a rape or incest victim, has to tell that victim, hey, by the way, I need to notify the sheriff about this accusation, just so you know. They're writing in scare tactics. They're writing in language to ensure that victims don't feel safe reporting their attacks, going for care, right? And we also know, I mean, the big fear, I think, for a lot of victims, in addition to knowing that the criminal justice system doesn't treat them very well, if there's a lot of, I forget what state it was, one state had something in their abortion ban that said if this victim was found to have made a false report, they could face 2 years in prison, right? And women are often accused of making false reports by police just because there wasn't enough evidence, right? Doesn't mean it wasn't real, but because there's not enough evidence, they're going to charge her with a false report. So there's a lot of punishment and cruelty sort of built in to the exceptions.
And we should say this also, in many cases, these penalties also involve the doctors. And from the doctor's perspective, it creates beyond a chilling effect on the doctors, because the doctor is not in a position to assess whether someone's been raped or incest. And when they make this decision, they are taking the responsibility that a rape did occur. And if it didn't, they could end up in jail, loss of their license, et cetera, et cetera. So the chilling effect is on both, sort of like both parties associated with the abortion. Let's talk about the timeline in terms of, like, because I know in North Carolina they passed a 10-week ban, I think it is, but it starts, if I'm not mistaken, it starts at gestation as opposed to conception. And my understanding is that gestation is actually 2 weeks, is counted 2 weeks prior to conception.
Yeah.
And so when we talk 6 weeks from conception in South Carolina and 12 weeks, I think it's North Carolina, it's actually 10 weeks.
Right.
Can you speak to this?
Sure. So I think that's actually Nebraska has that.
Maybe
North
it's Nebraska.
Carolina okay. has the same thing. North Carolina is also claiming to have a 12-week ban. That's actually a 10-week ban because they ban medication abortion at 10 weeks. And the vast majority of abortions in North Carolina are abortion medication. But yes, in Nebraska, they have this thing, as you said, where they're trying to call it a 12-week ban. Again, they're trying to make it seem more reasonable. None of this is reasonable, wouldn't be reasonable with any restriction. But as you said, it's not from fertilization. And so they're trying to play all of these word games with all of these bills so that they have the most extreme consequences, the most extreme laws possible, while sort of, you know, not sort of, lying to voters and lying to the media. And that's why I was really glad to hear you call the North Carolina ban a 10-week ban. It's so frustrating to see these bans described in the language that Republicans are using that is just so completely false, right? North Carolina's ban is not a 12-week ban. If 60% of the abortions in North Carolina are done with abortion medication and abortion medication is banned at 10 weeks, that is a 10-week ban, right? And I see this problem all the time where the mainstream media is really using the language that Republicans want right. them to use. It's the same thing with like calling it a compromise, calling it a middle ground, calling it common sense, reasonable legislation, right? They have been pushing this language out for months and months and months because they know that abortion bans are extraordinarily unpopular. I just wrote last night, the federal ban that all of these groups are pushing now, they won't call it a federal ban. They're starting to call it a national compromise, a national consensus, a national agreement, right? They'll do anything that they can not to call it a ban.
And we should also say, like, these are just like opening salvos, right? I mean, there's no logic to them stopping at, well, before we get to that,
yeah.
When we talk about the majority, you made the point in North Carolina that it's a 10-week ban for all intents and purposes because the vast majority of abortions are medical and there's a 10-week ban after medical abortion. But mm-hmm. the vast majority of abortions, my understanding, happen between 6 and 12 weeks. Is that right?
The vast majority happened before 10 weeks, really. I think it's like 83-84%. They're very early, yes.
Okay. And so, I mean, what we're seeing, but 6 weeks, I think we don't see, like, it's they really happen between 6 and 10 because
yes.
most people don't know they're right. pregnant until like week 5 or 6 to begin with.
After their missed period. Right.
Yeah.
When they need an opportunity to then get let the dust settle, make a decision, make an appointment, and with yeah. a backlog in these states, that might be literally impossible.
Right. The waiting list in a lot of places right now is weeks long. So a six-week ban is a total abortion ban.
Yep.
Right? It just is. And they know that. And again, this is all part of their effort to make it seem as if they are giving something up, as if they're compromising, as if they're open to conversation. We're being reasonable. Same thing with exceptions. It's absurd.
And just quickly on that, to return to the federal ban, because it's the same yep. dynamic there. It's the same dynamic there. Trust us, this is states' rights. We're going to leave it up to the states. And then what this is all doing, I mean, and Jessica, I guess I'm curious if you share my assessment here, is that they just want to get this goalpost moved so they can come back and have another bite at the apple immediately, which is what they're doing with the federal non-ban ban. I mean, Lindsey Graham was too brazen before the election, but now they're feeling emboldened and they're going to go for it.
Oh, yeah, they're fully going for it. One of the biggest anti-choice organizations in the country, Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, has made it very clear that that is their line in the sand for Republican presidential candidates. And again, the way that they're talking about it, they're talking about it as if this is something all Americans can agree on. We all agree that there should be some kind of restriction. No, we don't. And actually, the polls don't back that up. But they are going to continue to put that messaging out there, say that they are being completely reasonable and, you know, looking for a middle ground. And what scares me is that they're really trying to redefine the middle ground, right? We've seen folks like South Carolina's Nancy Mace, Representative Nancy Mace, who has been doing the media rounds talking about, oh, Republicans need to take it easy. They can't be so extreme on abortion. We all need to find a middle ground. And then she'll throw something in there like we can all agree on birth control access. Since when is birth control access
a controversy? Right.
They're really like they're doing this in a very specific, unfortunately, smart way that reframes the middle, reframes the conversation, and we can't allow them to do that.
And obviously, like, these are all, once they achieve, I mean, we're very close to the point. I think you made this point in I don't know if it was today's or mm-hmm. yesterday, but we're more or less the entire South. Is oh, yeah. essentially a abortion is banned. You know, Florida, all these states. And that's going to be the basis of their federal consensus ban. We're going to bring both the Union and the Confederacy, and we're going to, you know, and we're just going to come to some type of a broad consensus. Is it your sense, though? I mean, if you read the mainstream media about mm-hmm. this, it feels like they're not, they're just reporting it as if, like, you know, it's a ban, but there's exceptions and it's a middle ground and this and that. But do you think that, like, the general public is buying this? I mean, do you, like, how much of this is, because I'm just, as an analogy, and I don't mean to sort of like diminish the significance of this stuff because it's not necessarily analogous. But the dynamic of everyone was convinced that there was going to be this Republican wave because there was this narrative formed in the conventional wisdom, and it impacted the actual on the ground organizing and distribution of money. You know, maybe if people didn't think there was going to be a Republican wave, they send more money to Mandela Barnes and we pick up another Senate seat. But the point being is, like, the reality was very different. Is the idea that there's some type of consensus around here, or that people are finding some type of middle ground and they're doing exceptions? It's one thing for the Beltway media, the national media, whatever's left of it, to sort of like present it in that way. But do people living in these states, do people around the country, are they buying into it, or do they just simply, we don't hear from them?
They're not buying into it. NARAL did a recent study that asked, do you think, you know, a 15-week ban, federal ban, is reasonable, common sense? Overwhelmingly, no. And if you go to really any of these states, right, the vast majority of voters, vast majority of Americans don't want abortion bans, don't support abortion restrictions, even in red states. And I think one of the biggest problems we're seeing with the mainstream media framing of all of this is, if you read an article about abortion, you would get the sense that America is evenly split on this issue. You would get the sense that we are, you know, extraordinarily polarized on this issue. We're not. And as you said, the midterms showed it, right? Like, you're seeing votes in Kansas and Kentucky. No, we are not split on this. Republicans want people to think that we're split on this because so much of their effort right now is about undermining Democratic norms, right? What they're doing in Ohio with trying to change the standards around ballot measures. They are going to pass these bans whether voters want them or not. And so it's really important to them to get the message out there that we're somehow split, because the truth that this is a small group of extremist legislators passing these restrictions against the wishes of the vast majority of voters does not look good for them. And so that messaging is incredibly important to that broader strategy.
What's your sense of how to push back on that? I mean, obviously you're engaged in it, but we're starting to see again, and like it seems to come in waves where there is more attention paid to some of these horrible instances where these, you know, these bans in action lead to I don't know if it was a story out of Florida just the other day about this couple that their kid had, their baby had Potter's syndrome, yeah, and they had to carry to term and then literally just sit there for 90 minutes and watch the baby
asphyxiate because it could not breathe, and they knew this would happen. And it has had incredibly, it's done incredible mental harm to the family and to is it the trying to present more of these stories? Is it trying to work on the mainstream press and sort of making them reevaluate how they assess what constitutes a compromise? I mean, where from your perspective is the best ways in which to pursue this?
Sure. Listen, those stories are horrific and really important, right? These are happening. This suffering is happening. This cruelty is happening. But my concern is if we are only focusing on those stories, on those extremely tragic stories, you're giving Republicans the opportunity to say, okay, well, here's an exception for severe fetal abnormalities, and now we can all agree, right? No. Forcing someone to carry a pregnancy against their will, no matter what is going on with the pregnancy, no matter where they are in that pregnancy, is unjust. It's inhumane. And Republicans know it. If you look at a lot of these bills, right, the medical emergency exceptions, almost every single one of them has language in there about the fact that it's not a medical emergency if there's a mental health condition. Specifically, they will say, if a doctor diagnoses someone as suicidal,
right,
as a result of carrying a pregnancy that they're being forced to carry, that is not a medical emergency. They are anticipating the fact that women will become suicidal as a result of being forced to carry pregnancies. All of it is a horror story. All of it is a human rights violation, right? And to me, that is what we need to be focused on. It doesn't matter what the circumstances of the pregnancy are. No one should be forced to carry a pregnancy that they don't want, period.
But that's the point, is the they want you to have mental health ramifications because it's your punishment for being promiscuous or for having sex outside of marriage or for pleasure or for romance or whatever. I want to return to what you said about birth control, because we're seeing more and more efforts. I know, you know, this is kind of a little bit, it's completely related to abortion, but that they're going to try to ramp up efforts to control the IUD, the birth control pill, the morning after pill, maybe that comes first. Mm-hmm. Just like what you're seeing on the ground about that, because clearly for me there's a pattern of the methods of birth control that are in the woman or the person who can get pregnancy control, that's the stuff that they're going to come after first, and I think it's going to come more quickly than people anticipate.
Oh yeah, they're 100% already there, right? This is not something that's happening in the future. This is something that they are already doing. They have been laying the groundwork for years to call things like IUDs emergency contraception abortifacients, because they argue that it prevents the implantation of a fertilized egg, and therefore that's an abortion, right? And that was part of what the Hobby Lobby Supreme Court case was about. And so that's already enshrined. Like, we have that. We know that they are arguing that. Then you have groups like Students for Life, who I see quoted constantly in the mainstream media, and I never see anyone ask them about the fact that on their website, under birth control, they list almost every single form of birth control, unless it's a barrier method, as abortion, right? They believe birth control is abortion, and that is what they're going after. And the way we're going to see it happen, I think people have this thing in their mind where they're like, Republicans aren't going to turn around tomorrow and make birth control illegal. That's not how it works. They're not going to pass some bill that says birth control is illegal. They do the slow chipping away process that they did with abortion, right? They'll come after minors first. They'll come after young people. And they'll make it harder for insurance to cover it, as they did with Hobby Lobby. And so it's just that slow chipping away process. And even if birth control is legal, if no one can access it, it's not really legal.
It seems like all of this is simply, this is a dynamic, not, there's no, the end game here is, I think, hard for a lot of, frankly, normal people who are not fundamentalists, to really, I think, be able to see it clearly. I mean, this is all part and parcel. And one other thing I wanted to ask you about was, there's an interesting dynamic that seems to be forming where there is a
a relationship between the sort of the trans legislation that people are passing, that these the Republican legislators are passing, and they're using anti-abortion bills as a way of sort of like sneaking, maybe sneaking's not the right word, but sort of shepherding anti-trans. Like, this is, and when we talk about this in the context too of birth control, so much of this just is really, I mean, it almost sounds, you know, hackneyed at this point, but this is all just sort of about reinforcing a specific patriarchy and a set of gender norms that the Bible tells us we have to follow.
Exactly. It's about reinforcing those traditional gender roles and gender norms, both in terms of women need to stay in the home and be pregnant, and there is a gender binary, and that's it. And of course, all of those laws are about bodily autonomy, right? Doing away with the notion of bodily autonomy. And the other thing that's going on strategically for them is that they know, again, that abortion rights are so popular, right? They don't really think that they know that they don't have the support when it comes to abortion rights. They're hoping that if they can appeal to anti-trans bias, that somehow voters will be more likely to buy into this or be less furious about the laws. And hopefully that's not the case, but we know that the anti-trans bias, even unfortunately, like in the feminist community on the left, is still there. And so conservatives know that these issues are attached. And that's why it's so important for us to treat these issues as attached and connected.
All right. Lastly, let me ask you this. It seems to me that at one point, once they get to the level of abortion bans that they want, and I don't know what the ceiling is in terms of how many states, maybe it's 24, maybe it could be a federal ban. I think that's, well, it's not inconceivable, if they have three branches of government. But what about the idea of, like, crossing the state borders? What about the idea of mailing? I mean, the Biden administration made it pretty clear that they believe that the post office is authorized to deliver medical abortion across state lines. Do you have a sense of where, like, is there been any tea leaves as to how the Supreme Court would, let's say, ultimately rule on a case where a state says our authority to, if you're a Georgian, if you're an Alabaman, and you go to get an abortion in New York City, we can put you in jail, or if you send any thing through the mail, we can put you in jail or we can put them in jail. I mean, do you have a sense of, like, is there any tea leaves as to where the court has been on there? Are there any cases that give any, like, sort of like signs as to how various members of the court would rule on this?
I wish I knew. I feel like I don't trust any of my, when it comes to the Supreme Court, I don't trust anything I think anymore. We do know, though, that if Republicans win the presidency, they will be able to reinterpret the Comstock Act, right? Biden says it's legal to ship abortion medication. A Republican president will say it's not. And the important thing to remember about the Comstock Act is that it's not just abortion medication that would be impacted, but the tools that you use for a procedural abortion. And so that would be illegal as well. And so all of a sudden, New York abortion providers can't have their tools shipped to them. That would be illegal. So, and they are working on this.
So they could, even in states where abortion's legal, they could say nothing associated with an abortion can be mailed through the mail.
Exactly.
Like pot's legal in New York state, but you cannot mail it to the, okay.
Yeah, it's absurd. And the other thing that they're doing in pro-choice states is they're going town by town, specifically in border towns and towns that border an anti-choice state. And they are passing anti-abortion ordinances through local governments in pro-choice states saying, we're going to ban abortion by town in pro-choice states. And basically take all of the activist energy and effort and force people to sort of have these fights in pro-choice states as well. So they're coming at it from all fronts, really.
Is the Democratic Party doing a good job in making them pay a political price for this?
I mean, my biggest gripe at the moment really is the messaging. I feel like we are accepting their framework for the conversation, right? Abortion wins elections, and Democrats are still treating it as if it's this, you know, issue that they need to be careful about, that they need to tiptoe around, that they need to, you know, say all of this stuff about, oh, we just want to restore Roe. That's it. We're not going for anything further, right? Have a little backbone. Like, the voters are coming out for this. Treat it like the winning issue that it is. It, you know, Roe didn't protect us. We need something stronger than that. We need to be clear that abortion under any circumstances is a human rights issue. And honestly, this is part of why I'm doing the newsletter. We need to be talking about it every single day. Every day that I don't see the president, you know, Democrats out there talking about this, talking about how extreme this is. You're talking about half the population has lost their human rights. To me, there's no bigger issue.
Is there a divide? I mean, I can't help but think that the same sort of problems that we have with even when it comes to the debt ceiling, when it comes to a whole host of our politics, like, you know, Minnesota, for instance, has had just an amazing session. And I was just reading a piece about it. And they a local reporter made the specific point of saying we have a lot of younger politicians here who have a very different perspective. Even if the, you know, in their heart of hearts, their ideological, there's not as much ideological difference as one would think, maybe, but they say that their perspective on what their job is and what they should do with power when they get it is very different from the generation that preceded them. And nationally, we still have that generation. I mean, I know you know this, but for a lot of people listening to this podcast, they don't know that, you know, Hillary Clinton back in 2004 was one of the biggest voices for sort of like compromising on this issue, at least rhetorically anyways. Yeah. And, you know, that has bad effects because it makes the job that you're trying to do now and making people understand where we are that much harder because you're unwinding stuff. Is it your sense that within this sort of like in this set of issues that we're still stuck in this mentality from the mid 90s?
I think to a certain extent, yes, I think it's gotten better. But as you said, this framing of safe, legal, and rare, right? We are still seeing the after effects of that, right? That was such a powerful thing that Republicans today are saying, well, look, now what happened to safe, legal, and rare? They don't want compromise. They're so extreme. It's not extreme. There's nothing extreme about saying pregnancy is too complicated to legislate. It just is. We see this every single day. And so, yeah, I think that we're still sort of seeing the after effects of that. And I think when you look at a lot of, you know, the big mainstream organizations, they're trying to shift and change that messaging and change the way that they're thinking about it and understanding now just how much abortion wins elections. But yes, like local young activists have been there for a long time, right? They know their communities. They know that people support abortion rights. They know that we can talk about this in a non-defensive way. And I think we are starting to see people take their cues from them, which is great.
How hard is it for the sort of the major, like sort of long time institutional abortion rights groups to make that turn? Because as you mentioned it, like, I imagine they were really impacted by, you know, the most prominent female politician that we had basically in the Democratic Party sort of shifting the rhetoric, because that becomes a cue for donors, I would imagine, to these organizations. And I also would imagine that the donors to these organizations largely are, you know, older. That's when people have more money. And that influences how they operate. And it just has this sort of horrible trickle down effect.
100%, right? When you look at, and listen, these organizations are doing great work. Like, I'm not going to shit on big organizations, but yeah, if you look at boards of directors, if you look at donors, right, these are people who come from a certain generation who feel like they know precisely like what that messaging should be, and that being too radical, that being too aggressive, whatever that means, will that will pay a price for that, right? We know that. But I am still very hopeful, because so many of these fights now are really happening on a local level. But it does mean, and this is why at the newsletter and, you know, on social media, I'm constantly telling people, support your local abortion funds, support independent abortion providers, right? These big organizations, they're great. They're doing a lot of great work, but they have a lot of money, right? Like, who doesn't have a lot of money are the independent providers, the local abortion funds, who really are on the ground in their, not just states, but in their small communities, doing this work.
Really appreciate your time today, Jessica Valenti. Sure. We will put a link to the Abortion Every Day newsletter on Substack. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break here. But I have to say that, like, you know, in every silo of when we talk about politics, it always seems to get back to that the power remains in the Democratic Party in the hands of people who are always afraid of being too aggressive, mm-hmm. being too unilateral, being
the ball actually forward.
There is we used to call it hippie punching 20 years ago because it was so obvious. The fear was, like, we don't want to be like those hippies at the end of the 60s and the early 70s, and McGovern got crushed. And it feels like we are still, like, I don't know if it's 5 or 10 years away from having a new generation of politicians. We're still going to have ideological problems within the Democratic Party, it seems to me. Hakeem Jeffries is younger. We're still going to have ideological problems, but even that, then it will be only that, as opposed to a sense of, like, really misunderstanding the era we're in. They're going to have to pretend. Hakeem Jeffries is going to have to pretend that they're, you know, more to the left than they are, but the tactics they use are going to be more aggressive regardless.
Yeah.
Maybe the goals won't be as, you know, aggressive as we want them to be, but the tactics will be more aggressive.
To me, it's really like the neoliberal versus the New Deal public goods mindset. And it is, like, whether it's abortion or trans-affirming care, it's hard for Democrats who say, well, we're going to say, ask the market if you need health care, that actually you have positive rights to an abortion or trans-affirming care. Like, until we say you have right to all this health care, and that includes abortion, that includes trans-affirming care, like, I think this is why we're constantly, the wheels are slipping.
But I think that there's two different planes that we're talking about. Like, I do think that there is a neoliberal versus, you know, sort of the new
like
deal.
The access to care, like access to abortion, but, like, you should be able to get an abortion if you want.
But I think that's an ideological difference. I'm just talking about, like, a different attitude towards partisan politics, like, where, like, because, you know, and I think Nathan Tankus was right. Like, I think that, like, it is, the maliciousness is in the sense of, like, where they think the political value lies, and they're wrong. I mean, this is just like a non-ideological component, it seems to me. You're not going to, like, I think they don't care sufficiently about the cuts, without a doubt. But I also don't think that they care. I don't think that they care to have the cuts. I think that, like, literally, like,
They're managers.
They're managers, but there is a management style that I'm talking about, where it's a if you separate the ideological differences, there's a difference also in their perception of how you do partisan politics and the level of partisanship. You can be very good at partisan politics and still have that neoliberal bent. You just got to be more clever on how you hide the neoliberal bent. But because I don't think Biden, his agenda was for austerity. I also don't think he feels that strongly about giving away some cuts.
Right. Well, I guess like I'm saying, like, I think if you asked Biden or leading Democrats, do you believe you're a party of liberation? I think they would laugh at that notion. And that's the problem. Like, they don't actually see, they see it as managing. We inherited this post Nixon, and we're just going to try to keep this
maintained.
And that doesn't work throughout any point in history. Like you look at even like David and I talked about the 18th Brumaire in France, and like it's like the idea that post, like, they thought we could do another revolution and it's going to be sort of us in charge. But like, you can't just maintain this stuff because it's not made for to just maintain. It's not made to just maintain a status quo. It's made to dominate classes. Like,
I hate to split the baby, but like, I'm in between in that. I think that that's the ideological fight, right? But there is this generational divide in terms of like what to do with dealing with Republicans. Like, we even see it in younger, more centrist Democratic lawmakers, that they're more about opposition as opposed to like the political value of compromise. You even see it in slight generational differences between someone like Amy Klobuchar and Dick Durbin or something like that. Like, Klobuchar will get in there and pick at Republicans sometimes or go for those kinds of stuff. I think that there's a generational shift in doing politics little bit.
That's what I'm talking about. That's why I keep bringing up Michigan.
But to Matt's point, that could easily shift just like and slide right back into the same dynamics that he's describing if there isn't like the discipline for the Democratic Party to become that party of liberation.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But like, you know, that's why I keep bringing up Michigan, because you know, Whitmer and is it Nussel is the AG there?
Nessel.
Their politics are to the right of maybe even arguably of, like, you know, some of the national Democrats that we have problem with in Washington. But when it came to like abortion, they got aggressive in pushing that line. And that's just a how you do politics. They did not shy away from it. They're ideologically, you know, to the right, but they didn't. They realized that, like, there is no splitting. Forgive the pun, the baby here.
Right.
That if you're going to take a position, it is tactically just more effective to fight because people want to see you fight.
Yeah.
And maybe they would do this for, you know, means testing, for God's sakes, which would be horrible. Right. But they tactically have a different understanding of the political moment we're in, that there is no value proposition in, you know, dancing with your opponents across the aisle, essentially. Literally and figuratively. That's why those Democrats who got caught, like, with the Republicans, jumped in with that dance. Where was that? Where they were doing
in Florida.
In Florida.
Yeah.
Where those Democrats came out and said, we didn't invite them.
Right.
Like, this is for our purposes, not theirs. They just jumped in and they want to make that clear. Whereas I think there are, you know, other older politicians in Washington who would be like, well, we just thought it would be a good opportunity for everybody to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan and get together and have a beer, leave that all on the field. But we'll talk more about that in the fun half today. I have an announcement. We've been teasing this. So old Brendan, not that old. And I guess we don't really have a new Brendan. So I don't know why I refer to him as Brendan. But Brendan first joined the program. When did he come on, Matt?
5-6 years ago?
Yeah.
I think if I'm remembering what he's, I think he was 2017 or
2017.
So, or maybe late 2016, but I think he said 2017, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I mean, he's been on the show for 5 years. In the past couple of years, he decided that, he had to go get his master's in podcasting, if you can imagine, of all things.
They offer that?
Yeah. I said, that's not necessary. And he did it. And then, no, for like 2 years, I thought he was getting his master's in podcasting, and it turned out he was getting it in health policy.
Interesting timing.
And he is now graduated, I assume cum laude, but I don't know for a fact. And he's moving on, but they all come back. He'll be back.
Yep.
I mean, he'll be back.
Yeah.
It'll be a couple of years, but he'll be back. But and he's been booking in remotely the show for the past couple of years. He's been a huge help, and he really had a sense. So, you know, some of the great guests, I mean, particularly this year, like it seems like every other interview we do, people are like, that's a best of. And I mean, to the point where we're going to have to run some best ofs in July.
Right.
Just halfway through. So Brendan is moving on, sadly. But, you know, everybody moves into the emeritus status on this show. And joining us is going to be John Ahrens. John is a longtime radio and music producer. He's done produced shows for NPR member stations. He did a show in Philadelphia, WHYY, with Marty Moss Cone, I think it is pronounced. He did Vox's Today Explained. He's a musician and sound designer. Some of his music you've heard on Chapo Trap House series, Hell of Whoa. Presidents and Hell on Earth. Fresh Air with Terry Gross has done some of his music, and Transom with Marianne Williamson. Some of his projects include The Art Department and Dungeness with Jason Wozner of the indie band Y Oak.
That's very cool.
Yeah, look at so he's that. Got a whole range of stuff, and he's going to be doing our booking. So, you know, new John, I guess.
New John. Hi, John. Yeah. Well, we'll miss Brendan. Brendan's like, you know, been so great. And he was so helpful in bringing me on when I first started here, especially because we were remote. It was just the two of us sometimes in the studio. So I was learning to like get to know Brendan from behind the scenes. And then, you know, we became buddies. He's great. And the guests that you guys see and love here, so much of that is due to Brendan's diligence on that front. So,
totally. And hopefully he's going to be in town soon, and we'll bring him into studio. All right. So with that said, folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. Folks like Brendan and John don't grow on trees.
Mm-mm.
And we can do this because of our members. Join themajorityreport.com. Help this show survive and thrive. Join themajorityreport.com. And when you do, you get the free half free of commercials. You get the fun half. And you get to IM the show on the fun half as well.
Yes.
So check that out. You can do that through the app at majorityapp.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. And the AM Quickie. You're not gonna. I went over like. We get a message when people pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
We got people reading the AM Quickie now in some of the. I'm not gonna say specifically, but some of the highest reaches of our government.
Ooh. Well. I would like
state and federal.
Look at that.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to, yeah, I love the AM Quickie, but I don't get the other parts for free, like the Tuesdays and Thursdays that are behind
the
paywall.
That's a negotiation.
Okay,
can
I?
We can talk about that.
We can give you a gift sub.
We can talk about that.
You think?
Well, let's not,
for a limited
let's not
time.
Be too hasty. We'll see. We'll work on that. Meanwhile, it feels like 2004.
Oh, yeah?
It feels like
you got that Boston Magic back?
It feels like 2004.
Well,
you know,
you
get
I
a
mean,
bunch of head cases, and the beauty about head cases is that they can get really down, but then they can get really high.
Are you referring to Jason Tatum?
I might be.
Yeah.
Remember what happened after he came back in that fourth quarter? The next game, he goes crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
three more of those.
Three. Yeah, and go back to Miami for it. But, like, hey, we're not ruling that in it out. Gabe
and
Vincent.
And then you get to, like, save the coach's job who you need to move on from. But
well, anyway. That's true. He's got to get
it. Yeah, Gabe Vincent hurt his ankle, so we don't know. But we spoke about the Celtics, the now dearly departed Lakers on YouTube.com/ESPN show. Jimmy Butler, Matthew Tkachuk being incredible MVPs of the playoffs, Arizona Coyotes needing to get the heck out of Arizona. And we talked about analytics and their role in sports, as well as a bunch of other interesting topics. YouTube.com/ESPN show.
Oh, those nuggets are going to be real rusty.
Oh my God.
All that time to rest.
Yeah.
Going to be really rusty.
Oh yeah.
For the Celtics, who are going to be on fire, peaking at the exact right moment.
I'm ready to lose the first couple games in the series and then get down to business.
That's how you do it. You can win, what is it? Can't win.
Like me. That was me in
4-3 if you don't go down 3.
In college, it was, you know, okay, that's going to be doing 2 weeks. All right, that's doing 1 week.
Yeah.
All right, that's doing 3 days. All right, it's due tomorrow. Let's stay up all night.
They're just procrastinating, Sam.
Yeah, I mean, that's sometimes you need to feel like your back's against the wall.
Yeah, like the playoffs aren't urgent enough. Left Reckoning, we're talking, we already talked to Dolly Parkinson about the LaRouche cult, not only Lyndon LaRouche's weird history, including accusing like the Communist Party of the United States of being CIA-affiliated and attacking them with baseball bats as they were making their own connections with, for instance, arms dealers who helped Castro plots, the CIA's Castro plots. So interesting history, and then some of the more contemporary stuff with regards to why they're experiencing somewhat of a resurgence now. I think it's kind of straightforward. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get access to that.
646, I don't even know if we're going to get calls today, folks. But if we take calls, we will give the number. See you in the fun half. Best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude, you want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Two.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No.
No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like
me. Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.